Hello, and welcome to the History of the Cards, episode 88, The Iron Rod. So, the plan was to have this episode as an epilogue to the Fatimids period, but honestly, that interview from last week covered it all. The continuous evolution of Demitude, the dynamics of conversion, the demographics of Egypt, the linguistic changes, like I said, all of it. So, if you haven't listened to it yet, make sure that you do. It's long, but covers a lot of ground and have a lot of excellent insights. Now, we last stopped in the narrative in 1169. As Salah ad-Din took over as the vizier of Egypt, after a lot of actions and armies marching back and forth into and from Egypt. For those who were paying attention, I was careful to omit any references to the Coptic patriarchs during that period of transition. Well, this week, we would fill this gap and go back to after the death of the illiterate Michael in 1146, with the patriarchs John V and Mark ibn Zara. Pope John V reigned for almost 20 years, basically the entire duration of the chaotic transition that started from the death of al-Hafiz in 1148 to a couple of years before Salah ad-Din took over. So, as you can imagine, he really drew the short end of the stick. Unlike Michael, by all accounts, he seemed to be like a sensible choice, pious, well-liked, and maybe not the most learned, but he at least could read and write. He was a candidate for the office with Michael, a close second, so when Michael died within a year, the office naturally gravitated to him. The only obstacle to his elevation was a monk named Ibn Qadran, the one whose followers have allegedly poisoned Michael. As was the habit by this point with ambitious monks seeking the patriarchy, when it seemed like he wouldn't get it and John would be picked instead, Ibn Qadran, rather than accept the will of the crowd, went through the back door and involved the palace to force the hands of the bishops to ordain him. A maneuver that was partially successful, in that it forced all the bishops to come to Cairo and convene/consult with several Muslim palace officials to pick the new patriarch rather than go ahead as planned with the smooth ordination of John. Nonetheless, it ultimately failed, as in the council, the bishops formed a united front in their absolute refusal to even consider Ibn Qadran. Even when the same Muslim officials decided to move the council to Alexandria and see if the clergy there would be more open to Ibn Qadran, it went nowhere, as the Alexandrian, quote, shouted together with one word, John ibn Abu al-Fath is our patriarch. John here being John V. So, there was nothing the palace could do. This was toward the last few days of al-Hafiz's reign, so it's not like they had a firm hand to force the issue or anything. And so, John was consecrated patriarch in 1147, almost at the same time that Radawan waged his third and last rebellion that kick-started 20 years of instability and civil wars that we went through last week. After that, we barely hear anything from John, or about the Coptic Church, but records of church destruction, enslavement of the common folks as part of the civil wars, and on and off Demitude enforcement based on the whims of the many short-lived viziers of this period. Except for two noteworthy events where we can glean John's personality from. The first was a lengthy stay in jail for refusing to remove the bishop ordained for Ethiopia, who was quarreling with the king over there. John, despite a lot of pressure from the palace, never budged, and so he was imprisoned and stayed in jail for a while, only getting out when the vizier that imprisoned him was executed as part of the many rebellions that took place in John's reign, ultimately getting his way and never removing the bishop. Through this whole episode, he was impressively principled and essentially sticking to the book, where you're not supposed to remove bishops just because the king doesn't like them. The second is a Lindsay theological saga about the addition of a liturgical phrase, the word life-giving, to describe communion, i.e. the body of Christ. A monastery in the Delta had added the phrase on their own, which riled up some purists who insisted that nothing should be added or removed from the liturgy, where, as a reminder, it was being prayed in Coptic, memorized by heart by the priests, where neither they nor the congregation understood what was being said. So, adding an innocent word in there was a big deal for those who did not know what it meant, which was almost everybody by this point. John, our patriarch, not necessarily the most learned of his day, didn't like the changes either, and personally was against it. But again, principled and sticking to the book, rather than just tell the monks to stop it, he sent a committee of bishops who were comfortable theologically and in Coptic to investigate the addition. The committee, after their investigation, not only found that there's nothing wrong with the phrase, but recommended that everybody adopt it, basically to standardize the liturgy and avoid having everyone doing whatever they wanted. And John, despite being initially against the change, took the recommendation and sent letters requiring everyone to use the new phrase. Most, since the phrase was a small innocent addition, went along with it, at least agreed in principle, and continued doing what they were doing. Really, everyone kind of filed the letter in the drawer and moved on. Everyone except the monks of the monastery of St. Macarius, who made a public spectacle of refusing to accept the change. Now, to understand why all of this drama, I think a brief detour to the evolution of monasticism and the monastery of St. Macarius is due. Through the medieval periods, monasticism in Egypt retreated from its pre-conquest heyday. Rather than seeing monasteries all along the Nile Valley, at the edge that is separating the valley from the desert, the monks ended up mostly concentrating in three main locations. The western desert toward the delta, i.e. the wilderness of Sakides, or Wadi Natrun in Arabic. There, depending on the circumstances, existed at a minimum a Syrian monastery named after St. Mary, which housed, as you guessed it, Syrian monks, and the monastery of St. Macarius, probably the biggest of the bunch and by far the most influential. The second location was the eastern desert, toward the Red Sea. There, specifically at this period, a renaissance was happening as the Crusader states rerouted a lot of the trade routes toward the Red Sea, which brought money and pilgrims with them. In the interview with Dr. Wurzmiller, he mentioned a large art project / renovation happening in this period, which fits with the primary sources. That area contained also a couple of monasteries, one for St. Anthony and one for St. Paul. One of the monks of the St. Paul monastery, named Chinuda, was the one who wrote John's biography. And so you get the feeling that this area was taking over the helm from Wadi Natrun right about now. And the last location was deep in Upper Egypt. A monastery of St. Mary flourished and attracted Ethiopian and Nubian monks. All of these centers had plenty of monks and could claim, rightly, that they were the beating heart of Egyptian Christianity. All of them could, but only the monks of the monastery of St. Macarius did. The monks of St. Macarius, out of all these monks, kind of saw themselves as a special class, the guardians of the faith, so to speak. When a patriarch was ordained, he had to go there and pray the liturgy first, before praying in Cairo. Traditionally, when a patriarch passed away, he was buried there. They were the ones who argued with Gabriel about his addition to the liturgy, and he had to win them over. It was also from them where most of the bishops were picked. So in a way, they felt that theological and liturgical decisions had to flow from them, to be executed by the patriarch, not the other way around. At least he should have asked them before telling everyone to add the phrase. Well, John, principled as ever, stood his ground and told them that it's not them who decides, but a synod of bishops, which he is first among them. And no, he does not have to take their opinion. A legitimate process had taken place, and they must respect the outcome, whether they like it or not. They didn't like it, and had no desire to respect it. And so, a legitimacy campaign was waged between the patriarch and the monks, and who is right? A short one, as the monks of St. Macarius started to lose badly, as John was right. Plus, everybody else was going along. So, they decided to play a different game. Again, appealing to the vizier, the Armenian Shia convert at this point, to settle the dispute between them and the patriarch. This was right at the height of the brief stable period in his reign, so he could afford to get involved, and either out of intellectual curiosity, or more likely, hoping to collect a huge fine from the patriarchy, he agreed to consider the monks' complaints, ordering the patriarch to come and discuss the changes with the monks in his presence, where it would be he, a Muslim vizier, the one who decides what words to say in the liturgy and what words not to say. Now, as you can imagine, this was a very dangerous precedent, and John treated it very seriously. In the council, rather than address the monks gently and go into a secular argument of legitimacy, he was as fire and brimstone as you could get. First, addressing the vizier himself, he asked point blank, "Who is Jesus to you?" The vizier, a convert with a complicated view, could not quite bring himself to say a prophet as a Muslim would, or a god as a Christian would. Then, looking at the monks but addressing the vizier, he gave a short speech. The essence of it, really, this is the guy who you want to settle your theological dispute? A guy who can't even decide who Jesus is? The speech had almost no effect on the monks, but essentially did enough to throw the vizier off balance, to shut down the prospect of him offering his opinion. A contentious and hostile discussion then took place between the monks and John, where, and I'm going to quote from the History of the Patriarchs directly here, quote, "The patriarch raised his iron rod, which was in his hand, to strike some of them." Like I said, John was not messing around, and he was not going to be the patriarch that allows a government official to dictate liturgical terms for him. In response to the metaphorical and perhaps literal wooing that was taking place, the monks asked the vizier to protect them from the patriarch, to which he responded by, quote, "Stretch out you also your hands against him." i.e. go ahead and attack him physically if you want. A line that was too far, even to these monks. And they said they could do no harm to the patriarch. And so, the vizier ordered John to be arrested and jailed for a second time, with a large fine against the patriarchy. The liturgical term was not changed so, and John, even so, now in jail, basically have won the day. Suffering for the feast, he was now even more respected and beloved by the common folks and clergy. If before, some have seen him as innovating new liturgical practices, now his words are like those who are inspired by the Holy Spirit. The change stuck, and to this day, the word life-giving is still in the liturgy. A change that, and I cannot emphasize that enough, John disliked. But he was principled and believed in institutions. He did not go to jail for an extra word or two in the liturgy. No, he went to jail to preserve the right of the church to be the arbiter of the theological truth. Plus, possibly beating up an unruly monk or two. As for his stay in jail, well, it wasn't for very long this time. As we went through 2 weeks ago, the women of the dynasty were threatened by the Armenian vizier and arranged for his botched assassination. And after his death, the patriarch was released and resumed his duty until he died in 1167. A timely death, as he probably missed the last stretch of the transition, the one that saw the Bilbaeis massacre and the flooding of the slave markets, where things truly hit bottom for his flock. We are told that at his deathbed, he asked for a group of the notable civil officials in Cairo to come to him. There, a certain Abu al-Farag ibn Abu Asad, nicknamed Ibn Zara, as it was claimed that he was the great-nephew of Ibrahim ibn Zara, if you remember him, recommended that the patriarch takes a certain medicine, to which John responded by, quote, "O our father, I have used it." Now, the patriarch calling you, a random visitor in his deathbed, our father, is kind of special and was noted by those who were present. When he died, it was understood as a prophecy or even a conscious assigning of an heir. And it made sense, as Abu al-Farag, despite being a layman, was pious, generous, and in the mold of Gabriel, a well-liked, well-educated man of letters. He was as good of a candidate as they would come. So, like Gabriel before him, Abu al-Farag was ordained by the elite of Cairo, basically on their own, without consulting the monks, without most of the bishops, and definitely without anyone in Alexandria. At his elevation, the patriarch was given the name Mark, the 72nd Pope of our journey, for those who are keeping track. Despite the unusual election, Mark seemed to have a good reputation and was accepted readily by everyone. Helped by the tragedies that were going on when he started, where massacres and wars were going on daily. So most were just happy to just have survived another day, and definitely not in any state to fight over the election of a patriarch, who was spoken highly by almost everybody who have met him. And Mark, for his part, he got to work as best as he could with the constraints of the civil war that was going on. His first break came when the Franks versus Shirku versus Shawar war finally ended, and Shirku took power as the vizier. A very short break, as within a month, hoping to win over the mob elements of Cairo and the imams, Charcot started enforcing bits and pieces of Demiurge, ordering that the Christians and Jews start adhering to the special dress code. When he died a few weeks after, and Salah ad-Din took over, it was a very precarious transition that we will get to next week. But the gist of it is, Salah ad-Din was standing on a very shaky ground and grasped at anything or anyone to give him legitimacy and, to be honest, advice. One of these things or individuals was a respected chief Sunni judge named Al-Kabashuni, whose words carried a lot of weight on the streets and was fellow imams. He, as you would expect, counseled strict enforcement of Demiurge, as well as getting rid of the Shia caliphs. We will get to the Shia caliph part next week. As for Demiurge, well, listening to the advice and to appeal to that base and present an image of a righteous and a pious ruler, one of the first things that Salah ad-Din did was to take the bits and pieces of Demiurge that Charcot have started enforcing and run with them. And unlike most politicians, Salah ad-Din, as we will see time and time again, once he decided to do something, he did it well, executing on a very high level. Rather than just send a letter or two to his lieutenants, asking them to do it and move on, he really made sure that what he wanted was done. So, by year 2 of the patriarch Mark's reign, the government started enforcing very specific measures targeting the Christians in Egypt, as follows. 1. No visible crosses were allowed in any of the church's domes, and no church bells are to be rung. 2. The exterior of a church cannot be clean, but must be plastered with mud. 3. The Christian and Jews should alter their style of dress, that they may be distinguished from Muslims, and they should not ride horses or mules. 4. They should not be seen drinking wine, and they should lower their voices in their prayers and not have any public processions. Now, these measures are mostly symbolic in nature, with essentially no serious harm. But with them came a couple of things that did do that serious harm. First, Salah ad-Din enforced very strictly that no Christian could be the head of a diwan, or essentially a high-ranking government employee. This hit the economic well-being of the most well-to-do Copts, and a wave of conversion among this class took place. As the History of the Patriarchs puts it, quote, "A company of the Cairene scribes left their religion and denied their Christ." The second, the mob was emboldened and took matter into their own hand when a church happened to be not plastered with mud, or a Christian deciding that he would ride a mule. So these measures came with waves of church destruction and looting, as well as random lynching of individuals. We really don't know exactly when these restrictions eased up, but by July 1171, 2 years into his reign as vizier, the caliph died or was poisoned, and Salah ad-Din essentially managed to consolidate his rule pretty effectively, transforming into the Sultan of Egypt, where the ground was a lot less shaky. So, if you ask me, my educated guess would be a couple of years, an epilogue to a chaotic period of transition that ended up being forgotten quickly as the prosperity and the stability of the rest of his reign took hold. Which makes sense, as the Coptic sources of this period barely mentions the episode and speaks of Salah ad-Din in exalted terms as a good and a righteous ruler. One who, quote, caused them, i.e. the Christians, to draw nigh and favor them and employed them in his diwan, in the finances of his state, and he was gracious toward them, and they returned to a higher state than they had before, and they rode on horses and mules. As for the rest of the reign of Mark ibn Zarah, well, it was a very busy reign, where he rebuilt and renovated a lot of churches and monasteries. You know, once the Coptic civil elite class had proven itself indispensable to the smooth functioning of the Ayyubid state, they, alongside Mark, who was one of them, were able to financially support the restoring and the rebuilding of the churches. In addition, Mark's reign saw a certain fascinating priest, who essentially personifies an important transition. From a church struggling to find its theological footing with the linguistic and social challenges of the late Fatimid period, to one where its theology and liturgical practices are now firmly rooted in Arabic, with its elite, again, going back to writing complex theological and linguistic tracts within a larger Ayyubid empire. This priest's name was Marcus ibn al-Kumbur, a blind monk who became a wandering priest in the heyday of the civil wars of the early 1160s AD. There, going from town to town, in what seemed like the apocalypse, he made a career in public preaching and gathered a large following of folks who considered him to be a holy man, helped by the fact that he did all of his preaching and praying in Arabic, where all the other priests were still sticking to the cryptic Coptic. As Mark Swanson put it, he was, quote, a charismatic figure who laid out for his followers a clear path to salvation. That path and the subject of his preaching was three things. All Christians must confess their sins to a priest regularly. They must, weekly if possible, receive communion. And lastly, they should have a spiritual father, a confessor. Now, if you never heard of Marcus, and know a little bit about the common day practices of the Coptic Church, or even the Catholic Church, well, these three things seem pretty standard and innocent, definitely not controversial in any sort of way. Well, not so in his time. Marcus was an extremely polarizing figure, and his sermons sparked a revolution. This is not a theology podcast, so I'm not going to go into the nuances of Christian confession and all the baggage that comes with that. It's a bit of a minefield. I'm also going to go ahead and skip the topic of how often communion should be. For us, what matters is, by Marcus's time, confession was long abandoned as a sacrament by the Coptic Church. Yeah, people were not doing the sacrament of confession at all, i.e., confessing privately to a priest. And the church actively discouraged the practice. Why? Well, the reasons are not clear. It could be that it just have fallen by the wayside as the Copts' knowledge of their faith decreased to dangerous levels. Another theory, that there was a conscious decision to eliminate it as simony spread, and there was too many instances of priests taking advantage of their people's confession. And the last theory, perhaps the most controversial, is that it was never meant to be a sacrament for everybody, but when the fathers spoke of it, it was reserved to the monks. Like I said, so I'm not going to go into it. The point is, Marcus said that it should be done, and no one in the Coptic hierarchy thought that it was a good idea. As things stabilized late in Mark's reign, he decided to finally do something about Marcus and the issue. After talking to the priest and going nowhere, since the ancient Christian text kinda sort of supports the priest position, the patriarch held a synod, where Marcus was not quite excommunicated, since again, Mark, and probably most bishops, knew that he was not really wrong. Rather, he was just forbidden to preach, a directive that Marcus basically ignored and continued doing his own thing. As the patriarch continued to pressure himself, Marcus gave up and stopped trying to change things, instead going over to the Milkite Church, which was still alive and well, if somewhat anemic by this point. The change did not last though. Marcus the blind priest was a polarizing figure, and the Milkite patriarchy did not like him as well. So he tried going back to the Coptic Church, but was refused. So he self-exiled himself to the Milkite monastery, where he stayed until he died. Now, what about his ideas, you ask? Well, hold that thought. We will go back to them when we get to the patriarch Cyril ibn La'la', alluded to last week in the interview. Right now, what I want to emphasize is that the patriarch Mark, with the support of a whole synod, basically were unable to articulate a solid position on something as basic as confession. And he, by all accounts, was a man of letters, and by no means alone in opposing Marcus. In addition to the patriarch, Marcus earned a particular tough theological opponent, a certain bishop named Mikhail, Metropolitan of Damietta, a canon lawyer by trade. He, perhaps unwisely in a historical sense, put down in writing his opinions in opposing Marcus, and did not mince words. In addition to insisting on confessing to gods alone rather than to a priest, Mikhail also parsed anything that Marcus wrote, and basically dissected all of his mistakes, which, for the record, from what Marcus left in writing, shows him as you would expect, a simple priest with a gift of public speaking, but shallow theological understanding. So, if you forget about the confession stuff for a bit, he still got a lot of stuff wrong. Like I said earlier, here was a church struggling to find its theological footing, with a lot of linguistic and social challenges, underway to a comfortable ground, expressing itself in Arabic, but not quite there yet. As Mark and Swanson puts it, summing up the saga of Ibn al-Kumbur, the confrontation of Marcus Ibn al-Kumbur and Mikhail al-Dumyati does not appear to be a high point in the history of Coptic theology. Marcus was an idiosyncratic and sometimes theologically careless teacher who had one very important idea for the reform of the church in his day. Mikhail was a loyal Coptic Orthodox bishop who saw much of what was careless about Marcus' teaching, but who also doggedly defended current practices against Marcus' best idea for reform. Perhaps their encounter represents the last gasps of tired theology at the end of a gloomy century for the Copts. The remarkable thing about the story is how it goes from there. How a new generation of Coptic scholars writing in Arabic will emerge, putting a solid foundation of the Coptic Church in Arabic, one that persists to this day. Thank you for listening. Farewell, and until next time.